So journalism is about gathering information. And that is why I, Rick Sanchez, an American journalist, am here in Moscow. Man, we need to talk to each other. It's called free speech. Why would the Biden administration not allow something like that? Look, I don't know. We're supposed to be the country of free speech. But it's the decision they made, and it is as ridiculous as it might possibly sound. In fact, I want to tell you something else. What you're about to see that I am about to bring you is very important. You know why it's so important? Because it's important that we have and talk to each other, that we find a way to talk to each other. I have a chance to sit down with President Putin's top gun. This is the guy who negotiates with Ukraine. Now, look, you could disagree with what he has to say. You might like him. You might not like him. It's your choice. But you should have the right to hear what he has to say, just like Russians should know what we Americans are saying and thinking without filters. You know why you should especially hear what this man has to say? Because just today, there is a report that has surfaced suggesting that the United States is actively engaged in removing Volodymyr Zelensky from power. Now, since March, I've been telling you this. If you've been watching me, I've been talking about this in my reporting. That senior members of Donald Trump's administration have been having secret discussions since way back then with some of Mr. Zelensky's opponents. But today, there's this more important update, and here it is. The former prime minister of Ukraine is now quoted as saying over the weekend that the United States has now given the go-ahead for Mr. Zelensky to be removed from power. The guy who's saying this is named Nikolai Azarov. He used to be Ukraine's finance minister up until 2007, and before that he was the prime minister. He says Zelensky will be replaced by the head of the Ukrainian legislature, or the Rada, as they call it, and they will then choose a president who will shape the new political landscape of Ukraine. Important to note, no comment, as far as we can tell so far, on this from Washington or from Russia, officially. But this is the kind of thing that goes right to the heart of this exclusive conversation that I am about to share with you. Let me tell you about who this is. This is Vladimir Medinsky. See him? He is the lead negotiator responsible for coming up with a deal to end the war in Ukraine. I mean, this is Mr. Putin's guy, right? He's also one of Russia's most respected thinkers and historians. You're going to hear me, as I talk to him, challenge him on his freedom to reach a deal, or whether he's even allowed to. Is he getting resistance from Mr. Putin, who maybe, or somebody else in the Russian government, who maybe doesn't want him to do that, to reach that deal? You're going to be fascinated by what he has to say. You're going to be fascinated to hear him explain how much he likes his Ukrainian counterparts, the people he's sitting there talking to. He says, I like them. But how he fears at the same time, as he tells me, that they're frightened, that they're scared. They're even afraid that they might possibly be assassinated, he says, for agreeing to a deal. Now, ask yourself, why would he say that? Why would he say that the people he's talking to are afraid that they might be assassinated? You're going to hear him respond as well to why many Russians are mad at him and mad at Mr. Putin. And you're also going to hear him react to President Trump and the big three, Starmer, Merz, and Macron, who he says are bigfooting Ukraine. Bigfooting Ukraine. Here now, my exclusive discussion with Vladimir Medinsky. This is such an important conversation that you and I are about to have, because there are hundreds of millions of people around the world who I hope will hear this conversation that you and I have. And many of them who live in the West have been asking strange questions, in many ways because they're led to believe that Russia is not serious about negotiating a peace deal with Ukraine. I've heard say neither side really wants a peace deal. And in fact, I've even heard my friend Marco Rubio say it. I've heard my president intimate the same thing. So the question is, and I think this is important to get it on the record, is Russia committed to a good faith negotiation to find a peace deal with Ukraine? And there are no barriers on you, neither from Mr. Putin or from the Russian government, to achieve that aim.
I will say one thing, Rick, which I have never said before publicly. If Ukraine wanted, if Ukraine were ready, if it made its own decisions, we would have been able to sign on February 28, 2022. During that first meeting, and the conditions would have been much softer than what we're offering today. By and large, all we have wanted is for Ukraine not to enter NATO, not to have any NATO military bases on its territory. I told them, you can be like Austria, a beautiful, prospering country. You can have an army like Austria. And second, bring back the Russian language and the Orthodox Church. Make them equal. Give them equal rights. Because that's amazing. You can speak Arabic in Israel. You can speak Hebrew in Palestine. But you cannot use Russian in Ukraine. There, actually, three-fourths of the population are speaking Russian. And more than half of them deem Russian to be their native tongue. They don't really speak Ukrainian that well. And the third point was for them to recognize Crimea. Because Crimea, you have to admit, had the most democratic referendum you could imagine.
So says Gallup, so says Pew, the two most respected polling organizations in the world, went in and found that 85% to 93% of the people believe that the referendum was correctly done and accurate. I'm only quoting, not my words.
Absolutely. It is a nation's right to self-determination. It is a basic freedom enshrined in the United Nations Charter. It is a basic freedom that even the French fought for in the 18th century, that a nation must have the right to self-determination. And the last item in our proposal was that there are two territories in the Donbass, two regions that did not want to be part of Ukraine. Earlier, we proposed that they become part of Ukraine as autonomous regions, so that they can choose their own governors. People in Russia choose their own governors. I go and I vote for the mayor of Moscow. People in the U.S. vote for governors and for mayors. But in Ukraine, the presidential office appoints the governors. There are no gubernatorial elections. Just let the people choose their governors, and they will come back. But Ukraine refused. Kiev said, we will take them back by force. But they failed to do that. So, on February the 28th, 2022, we said, okay, you failed to conquer those territories, and you will not be able to live with them longer. Just leave them alone. So we reached an agreement during our first round in Istanbul. We drafted a treaty. I remember it was 19 pages long. It was very detailed. It went as far as having wording that was interpreted in the same way in Russian, Ukrainian, and English. So on the 15th of April, President Putin reviewed the treaty, and he made one amendment as a lawyer. That's his first education. I transmitted it to Zelensky, and then Zelensky was silent for weeks. They said he was very busy.
Really?
It's a text that is too big and too complex. It turned out that during those 2 weeks, he had hosted Boris Johnson, the head of Biden's State Department, and the head of Biden's Pentagon. They all came and had meetings, and after that, they told me that the foreign partners were against signing a treaty that had already been coordinated with them.
They said that. The Ukrainian.
They said that to my face.
That they're turning down the deal because they were told to turn down the deal, essentially. Yeah. Then.
Exactly.
Wow.
They said their foreign partners do not support the signing of a treaty, and they would not guarantee aid or security if we signed that treaty. We would go to war with you, and we would engage in war until you win or we win.
Let me ask you, because I want to be fair, and I just asked you, and it seems you're giving me a forthright answer, that indeed, you have come in with essentially the same plan that you offered 2 years ago again, and it has not changed. And the most important thing is Ukraine cannot become a satellite country for NATO. Ukraine has to maintain itself as a sovereign, independent nation. And that's really, it seems to me, the foundation of what your negotiating demands are. But here's the question that I have to press you on now, because you're meeting with these guys. You're sitting with them, the Ukrainian side. You tell me Russia is in a good faith negotiation to find a solution. Can you look at these guys that you're negotiating with and tell me that they're also negotiating in good faith, or is someone mandating what they can say and what they can't say?
Last time, they were more independent, and there was more freedom in their actions. And now I see that they're less independent.
Really?
What that reminds me of is it's like seeing a top manager hide in a huge corporation. Some decisions are up to them. But the matters of principle, whether to buy or sell the company, whether to issue new shares or enter a new market, they would need to consult with the board. So this is what I'm reminded of. They also become very nervous. They're constantly looking at each other. It feels as if they're watching each other.
In the negotiations, right. Like they were afraid? Like, did you sense like a tension? Like they were afraid to commit or to say anything?
Well, it's no surprise. As that time, they had a small delegation, 5 or 6 people, and after the talks, one of them was assassinated right after the talks finished. And it was the Ukrainian security service that killed him.
Denis Kariv, March 2022, unofficial participant in the talks, killed, we think, by SBU. Interestingly enough, do you believe?
They never said he wasn't killed by the Ukrainian security service. He was killed by their security service in downtown Kiev.
For what? For something he said? Do you remember when in the conversation?
I remember him. Why do I remember him? I remember him very well because I think it was the first day. It was February 28th. We had a break and everybody went to have a smoke or to go to the bathroom or maybe to drink some coffee. And I think it was near a bar. There was a bar counter there. There was no bartender, and I stood there with Kiriev. We had a conversation maybe for 15 minutes about life in Crimea, because he used to live in Crimea, and we had a conversation for about 15 minutes about that. And after the break was over, we went back into the room. So that's why I remember him, and it was just a small talk.
Do you think they saw you talking with him and thought maybe you guys were too close?
Or? Everyone saw that I liked him. So it was no secret, and we didn't push anyone away. Some people came by to talk with us.
But here's the big point here. Here's the takeaway, right? The takeaway for me as a journalist is the possibility that some of the people that you are negotiating with, maybe, let me be very careful with my words, but they feel like they have a gun to their head in terms of how careful they have to be, what they agree to or don't agree to. In other words, they don't have the freedom the liberty to have a true good faith negotiation. Do you sense that?
Да. Я это чувствую.
Yes. Yes, so that's what I feel. I feel that deep down, they're better than they're trying to look. They even want to say some things, but they can't. I saw 2/3 of the delegation were in the military uniform. They are military officers. And I look into their eyes. First, they're no different from Russian people. They look exactly the same. The uniform is similar. And what I see in their eyes is the unwillingness to fight. They don't want to go to war. They don't want to send their soldiers to die. Maybe because there's something human. What it takes to be an officer is still in them, because an officer must keep their soldiers safe as much as possible. I feel that.
So it sounds like what you're describing to me is a situation where someone, most likely it has to come from the top, Mr. Zelensky, doesn't want there to be a peace deal, and that may have something to do, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but it may have something to do with why we're seeing an escalation of attacks on civilians in Russia, for example. Do you think those two things are tied?
Я бы разделил украинский народ.
I would draw a line between the Ukrainian people, the Ukrainian army, the soldiers and those who suffer the most, those who are closest to the front, those who are being hit, and a small part of the ruling elite. Because, you know, it's like you're from Cuba, and I think the Ukrainian leadership, and I will try to speak very carefully, but to some degree, they're starting to look like Latin American dictators to me. At some point, they used to be good guys. That's when they came to power, and they promised a lot in the election. But then, gradually, they get reborn into dictators. And if you want to stay in power forever, you need a permanent enemy, and you need a war that does not threaten you personally in any way, and that does not threaten your family, because your family is abroad with British passports, and they feel very safe, and you cannot stop the war because you would lose control of the situation. Especially since foreign aid, weapons, money only flows as long as you are in a war. After the war is over, you lose this external support, and you lose the possibility to suppress any opposition that may arise in the country. And you will have to go for elections, and you will lose it, because people are tired. They want peace, and the soldiers want peace.
So you're saying the war is a necessity for the ruling party, including Mr. Zelensky in Ukraine, where for Russia, it's not a necessity.
Yes, absolutely. We don't need a war at all. So why did Ukraine see its situation deteriorate so much? Because 4 of its regions had referendums, and now they're part of Russia, officially. And Russia cannot leave those territories because it would be a betrayal for those people. You cannot betray the people. They are written down in the Russian Constitution as an integral part of its territory. But if you stop the fight along the line of contact, if you don't sign a true lasting peace, if you just have a ceasefire, you know what will happen? There was the Karabakh region between Armenia and Azerbaijan. If it's a disputed territory, the region will become a huge Karabakh. And at some point, Ukraine, together with NATO, or if it becomes part of NATO, will try to get it back with force. And it will be the end of the world. It will be a nuclear war. We don't want to have a huge Karabakh. We don't want to have a pretext for a nuclear war on our side. A territory that will not be recognized by anyone will cause trouble. So we want to stop with a lasting peace and to have the territories recognized.
Would you say that Russia's reaction thus far throughout this war has actually been mild-mannered? Let me tell you why I'm asking you this question. I've only been in Moscow for 3 weeks, maybe 4 weeks. So I don't know. But I talk to people because I'm a journalist. So I talk to drivers, I talk to people, and they love speaking English, so they all come and talk to me. And I find that most Muscovites and most Russians are angry at Mr. Putin and at you because too much talk, tired of talking. What those people are doing to us is horrible, they say to me, and it's time to start lobbing the bombs and getting rid of them. We're mad at those people. Do you feel that? And as a, you're a peacemaker. What is your reaction to that feeling, if I'm right, if you think I'm right?
Yes, our population does indeed demand that we take much stronger actions. And it was difficult for us to go for a second round of talks when Ukraine made a deliberate effort, blowing up a passenger train, killing civilians, including children. Sometimes it happens that a missile is flying against a military target, and it is jammed, and it hits a residential building, and it leads to casualties. Sometimes the buildings are hit, and people die under the rubble. It is terrible, but it is part of the war. But when you have a passenger train, I think it was a two-story train, you can see from a long distance, and the person who blows it up, who blows up the railway and the road under it, when they see the train and when they press the button was pressed manually. It is terrorism. It is not a train with tanks. It's not even a train with fuel. You can clearly see it's a passenger train, and they killed civilians on civilian territory.
And that's what makes Russians angry. Yeah.
Exactly. And after that, people say that we must strike them with the Oreshnik. We must destroy Kiev or Lvov, that it's enough with the talks. And so, of course, it's difficult for us.
Why do you think Zelensky sent his chief of staff to Washington after his conversations with you?
Well, usually the goal is just to ask for more weapons and money, just to beg for more, to have the American taxpayers keep on funding him. I think you've already paid some billions, 200 or 300 billion, to fund his life there. It's like the Marshall Plan during World War II.
Do you know how much the Marshall Plan cost? $140 billion. Do you know how much, in today's money, do you know how much my country has already spent in Ukraine? $240 billion. That's crazy.
В современных ценах, да, в современных деньгах, план Маршалла, да?
Yeah. In modern money, yes.
It's crazy. That's in modern money, right? Well, the Marshall Plan money went to build things. But this money that you're giving now is used to kill and to destroy. So it's an anti-plan, an anti-Marshall Plan. Biden was the anti-Marshall.
It seems to me that as important as your negotiations with Ukraine are, what the world really needs is a good, fair negotiation that is fruitful between Russia and the United States of America. That is primordial to anything. And until that happens, say people who are smarter than me, everything else doesn't matter quite as much. Do you agree with that?
Yeah.
You do?
Да, я согласен.
Yes, I do. I agree, and I believe that a lot really depends on how the relations between Russia and the U.S. will play out if there is peace. The United States will not only stop spending so much money on the war and destruction, it will get huge economic benefits because you signed a treaty on rare earths. And all of those rare earths are just a Chinese share of the incredible riches that are available in Russia and of how much American businesses and American citizens could get through investment projects in Russia, through partnership with Russia and mutually beneficial trade.
I need to ask you as well about this deal that you offered to return the remains of some 6,000 soldiers. I'm trying to understand why Ukraine is so freaked out about this. Like, they're, like, totally, I mean, they wigged out, like it's insulting, like they're angry because you want to send 6,000 soldiers. It seems like a strange thing to be angry about.
Мы думали, они скажут нам спасибо.
We thought they would say thank you because 6,000 families would get a decent burial for their sons and husbands. They would be able to give them a Christian burial in the ground. Currently, they're frozen in their uniforms, the Ukrainian army uniforms. Some of them have documents in cellophane. The Red Cross gave us those bags, and they're lying there in those bags. It's several trains worth of refrigerator cars, actually, and I want to tell you that part of this 6,000, namely 1,200, are at the Ukrainian border. The authorities are refusing to accept those bodies. Why? First, it is difficult for them to acknowledge such big losses. We also told them that they can use our refrigerators to reciprocate and to give us the bodies of Russian soldiers. And, most of all, in 2022, I believe, Ukraine adopted a law for families of the fallen to get compensation, which is fairly big. And from American money, of course. But the money that the United States and Europe gave Ukraine is not used for compensation. It is being used for other things. And it is up to you to investigate those things. It's about $350,000 per one confirmed death. That is what the American taxpayer is paying for.
$350,000 times 6,000 comes out to more than $2 billion. Does it?
Да. Да. Да.
So,
но этих денег нет.
So,
они потрачены. И никто платить их не хочет.
But the money is not there. It has been used up, and nobody wants to pay them. I think Ukraine has not paid anyone since they adopted the law. They announced that someone is missing in action, and so the families cannot get compensation. As announcing the deaths would mean that they would be officially recognized as eligible for compensation. So, as one of my American friends says, whatever they tell you, remember that ultimately it's about money.
They're acting like they're mad because this is not a good deal, but in actuality, it's an act. What they're really saying is, we don't want to pay $2 billion. And I think that's maybe what these numbers seem to bear out. Let's go back to the negotiations. Maybe we need to finish there because I hope, and I think most people in the world hope, that we can have some kind of solution here. I mean, I know people throw out the term World War III and this is all about world peace, and it really is. So we all hope, you being the lead peacemaker, that you can find it within yourself and within your abilities to make them understand why it's so important for the good of Ukraine, especially, but also for the good of Russia and for the good of the world to come up with some peace deal. You spoke with in a private meeting for 2.5 hours after the last session. Did you get a sense, talking to those officials, that maybe there's a little more ability there or a little more room for compromise, or yet?
Вот когда с ними разговариваешь, с членами украинской делегации...
When you talk to the members of the Ukrainian delegation without cameras, unofficially, they are decent people, by and large. And they want to stop the bloodshed, in principle. But the problem, as I think, is that Europe, the current shareholders who deem themselves to be the shareholders and the owners of Ukraine, do not allow Ukraine and its top management to reach agreements that would be beneficial for Ukraine. The head of the previous Ukrainian delegation, he's a smart guy. I would say he's intelligent and flexible. He's a good negotiator. So he told me at one point, he said, Vladimir, it's easy for you. You have one boss, and I have three.
Merz, Macron, Starmer.
Well, back then, those were different names in 2022, but yes.
Yes, but no different.
Это самая большая проблема.
So that is the biggest problem. If they're guided by the Ukrainian people's interests, I see that they're living people, and they're human. I see it in their eyes, and they realize they can get to an agreement rather quickly on acceptable terms. So what is the difference between Trump and Biden? is very simple. Trump says America first, that American interests must come first, and he doesn't care about the rest, and all the other problems in the world will be viewed through the benefit to Americans. That position is entirely clear, and that is the only way a head of a country must behave. They should not think about Britain's, the EU's, or even China's interests. Trump thinks about American interests, and Ukraine must think about Ukrainian interests. That's that.
By the way, and that leads me maybe to you and I could talk forever, and I don't want to take, you're a very busy man, and you're doing some very important things. And I probably would like to finish with that, Mr. Trump, and your expectations of what he is doing and what he can do. I also want to mention something, because I'm here interviewing you. I want all of you who are watching this interview to know that Mr. Medinsky and I did not speak before this interview. He did not know what I was going to ask him. He did not supply me his questions. This is a complete, open, and honest conversation, and that's all it's ever been. And I only say that to underscore that oftentimes, and it makes me angry when the West thinks that their brand of journalism is better than ours. It's not. It's not. You and I did not speak, right? Nothing. Everything has been fresh. Two guys having a conversation. So, which leads me to my last question. And this is important as well. There's a power struggle in America right now. There are those who truly believe that our foreign policy needs to change. There are the Mearsheimers. There are the Jeffrey Sachs, my friend Tucker, Colonel McGregor. A lot of people are now coming to the realization that we are fighting endless wars for no good reason other than to make a few people rich and the rest of the country is getting no advantage of it. So it's starting to filter through the country. But Mr. Trump still has to deal with those who don't want that, the neocons, the war profiteers. Sitting back looking at so far what he's done in just the 4 or 5 months he's there, do you think he's negotiating both sides well? What advice would you give our president?
Я ніхто, щоб давати совети.
I'm in no position to give advice. I just listen to what Trump says, and his national conservatism is entirely understandable. You must do what is best for America and for Americans. If the Americans feel it fits them to put all their money down the drain for Zelensky and losing trillions in possible contracts with Russia and other countries, why? Why would you do that? Why would you lead wars that make no sense? In this regard, I would like to say that I heard the Munich speech by Vice President Vance, and it is very clearly the case of a person saying what he believes to be right. It was a very good speech. President Trump's speeches show that he only thinks about American interests, not the senators' interests, who think about PR or something just to introduce controversial bills. I used to be a parliamentary member myself, so I know that in Parliament you have your own interests. But if you're head of state, if you're responsible for the country, your interests are different. You don't think about your constituency's ideas. You think about the country as a whole. In this regard, Trump's policies are very clear to us so far.
And hopefully he can resist that pressure happens in any government. But there are people who make way too much money to allow him not to be involved in wars. Mr. Biden obviously allowed those people to run in many ways, I believe, if you'll allow me to say it, his administration. And now I think there's a battle going on in Mr. Trump's administration. I hope it works out.
Я ещё хочу кое-что сказать. Мне кажется, что Трамп...
I want to say one thing. I think Trump believes in God. But the previous administration did many things that you can burn in hell for. So I think Trump at night sometimes thinks about what people will fondly remember him by. He wants God to see him as a good person. He wants to be a peacemaker and a unifier, as he says, and that's a very good formula.
From your words to God's ears, one can only hope. What a wonderful conversation. Thank you so much for sharing. I know you're in the heat of the battle right now. negotiating with Ukraine. You are, Jesus said, you are a peacemaker. And it's the most important mission for anybody at this time, given what's going on. So thank you so much for taking time
to share it with us.
Thank you. That was a very interesting conversation. Very good questions.
I come to you from an American Western perspective, so maybe we look at things a little differently.
But thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, sir. And we appreciate it. Look, whether you agree or disagree with Mr. Budinski, there's one thing there that I think we all can agree on. His voice, what he has to say, should be heard by hundreds and millions of people. It's important. And you know what? I think it will be. That's our news. But I want you to know that you can hear my bonus comments on this Budinski interview on my podcast. It's called Journalistically Speaking. You can find it on YouTube. We also call it JSpeak for short, by the way. And you can also reach out to me and we can have a conversation on X or Twitter or whatever it is they call that thing these days. So this is the Sanchez Effect. This is the place where truth goes beyond borders. And you know what? This time, we will not be silenced. I'll look for you next time. Good night.